Hello, everybody, and Happy New Year, and welcome back to the Latino Vote Podcast. My name is Chuck Rocha, and I am joined by my brother from another mother, Mike Madrid. How was your New Year's, Mike?
Chuck, it's been fantastic having a little bit of a break. The New Year's holiday was great. A little bit underwater and a lot of damage going on here in Sacramento right now, but I have really looked forward to getting back on the mic with you because this is going to be one hell of a year coming up.
It's going to be crazy. And to remind everybody, Mike lives in Sacramento. I'm not going to give you his home address because he has so many fans that will show up at his doorstep. But you should know he's been heavily impacted by that big storm that they're having. Now, Mike, correct me if I'm wrong. The last time I was out there in the armpit, in your city, there was a drought happening, I thought. And now you're getting torrential rains?
Yeah, torrential rains. We've gotten as much rainfall in the last 2 weeks as we get normally in a year here. It's caused extensive damage, a lot of trees falling. There's a lot of mature trees. We call it city trees here in Sacramento. A lot of them have fallen and torn up cars, taken some lives, unfortunately, ripped houses in half. And we're about, I think, three more atmospheric river storms are coming through. So we're not even halfway through it, and a lot of damage has already been done. So we're just bracing for the worst you're getting
ready for. Has your house been damaged? Are you okay?
No damage has been done, fortunately. I was out of power for 4 days, which is a real thing.
Wow.
Yeah, just got to kind of buckle up, blanket up, and get ready for it and make you – grateful for everything that we've got, but everything's fine. Everybody's safe.
Good.
Let's hope that it stays that way. But yeah, tough times coming for Sacramento and all of California right now.
Well, I hope all of our listeners got a chance to get a little bit of a break over the holidays. It's one of those rare cycles, and Mike doesn't live through it as much as I have to these days, but it's these cycles coming off the midterm where we have an incumbent president. So there's not a kickoff of a presidential primary. And it's truly, and I told my staff this, you know, one of the times when we're really not being bothered by somebody worrying about doing something in the beginning of January. So we really got a break. Hat tip to my team who got some really well-deserved time off. For those of you who follow me on social media, you'll know that I got to experience a once-in-a-lifetime trip to Cuba. Me and Ebony went to Cuba and spent a week in Cuba going from almost the far west side of the island all the way to the east side and spending 3 days in Havana. And I really, Mike, learned a lot. I mean, we talk a lot about Cuban voters on this podcast and Colombian voters and socialism and capitalism. But, you know, going down there and interacting with the people and talking to all the different cab drivers and the service staff, you know how I am. I want to talk and find out really what's going on. There's a big exodus of people right now leaving Cuba, coming to America, and probably the second busiest or biggest migration ever from Cuba. And after spending a week down there, man, I see why. I don't know if the listeners know this, and then I'm going to kick to you, Mike. I'd like to know your opinion of the island and what's been going on. But I spent New Year's there, and I found out that the number one industry in Cuba is tourism. For all of you in America who don't realize, there are still a ton of European and mainly Canadians who spend a lot of time in Cuba. It's a really cheap place. It's beautiful. They have world-class resorts on the beaches, especially in the central northern coast of the island. So that's number one. Number two industry in Cuba is remittance, Mike, from the United States. People sending money back to Cuba. Cuba takes a percentage of that and keeps it. That's their second biggest income. And then there's some smaller things. But when you've got COVID and then you've got supply chain and something else I didn't think about, which was the locals told me this, when Donald Trump made them be one of the terrorist countries and named them and put them on the State Department's axis of evil, they couldn't get things like they used to from certain places. People couldn't immigrate. And what this caused was this horrific downturn in their economy, and nobody can get the best way to describe it. Now, I'll turn it over to you, Mike, and see what your thoughts are. One of the cab drivers said, Cuba is the maybe country. He said, today, maybe there's chicken, maybe there's not chicken at the corporate store. He said, maybe there's gasoline for our cars, maybe there's not. And there's a whole separate conversation about these old cars that we all love. And I fell in love with, and I love old cars. And because of the embargo and what happened in the late 50s, there's all these old cars. Well, it's become such a lucrative industry, Mike. These guys were saying that England, French, and Italian companies are coming in and buying between 2 and 10 of these old cars, paying local people like $20,000 or $30,000, $50,000 a piece for these cars. And then they are charging exorbitant prices to tourists to where they could quadruple their investment on these cars over just a couple of years. Man, I learned so much. I don't know if you spent much time in Cuba.
You know, Chuck, I've never been to Cuba, but I'm expecting you to invite me on one of your junkets down there at some point in time. I will say this. I mean, I really think we need to spend a little bit of time on the Cuban diaspora. I'm talking about the island and the politics there, I think, are really fascinating. But I do want to dig into some of the Cuban voters here for a couple of reasons. The first is, while the Cuban vote is not that big, and you've heard me say this time and time again, the Cuban percentage of the Hispanic Latino population in the country is like 6%. But where it's geographically located, of course, in the southern part of Florida, in the battleground state of Miami, has allowed for it to have an extraordinarily disproportionate amount of voice in our politics, particularly in the Republican Party. Democrats, of course, have had to react to some of that because it's been Florida. As Florida moves into the red column, Democrats pulled states, as we know, in the midterms. That's going to change. And with the rise of the Mexican-American vote, we're really going to start redefining, I think, a lot of what the Latino agenda is. But for the interim, we got to get a couple of guests in here that can talk about the Cuban politicization process, what's happening on the island, how it affects the Cuban vote here. And I think really interestingly, you just tapped into this, what's happening with the Cuban immigration issue right now. I hate to use the word crisis, but there's boat lifts happening again. The Cuban voters, by the way, are the most, of all the Latino subgroups, they're the most, I'm going to use this term maybe a little bit too loosely, they're the most anti-immigrant. They're the most supportive of restrictions, especially on Mexicans, even though they have gotten exceptions from the island continually. Every time there is an immigration surge, Congress creates this Cuban exception. It goes back to the Cold War, the wet foot, dry foot policy that started really in the 1990s. There's going to be another exemption coming up in the next couple of years. It's something that Latinos, if there is this Latino vote that we talk about, Cubans are going to have to start being a little bit more honest with the rest of the Latino community about what constitutes immigration reform and what does not, because there's always a carve out for Cuban emigres, always a carve out for people coming from the island. They leverage the communism there. They leverage the old Castro stuff. They become cold warriors all over again, but they are the first to say, enough Mexican migration, enough Central Americans, enough people coming from South America. No more of those coming in, and Cuban Americans are going to have to reconcile that as they start to see their power diminish. Those are just some of my initial thoughts. I know we've got Alejandro Frost elected. I know you've got a relationship with him. We've got to get him in.
We should get him on. Yeah, and we should have that just a whole Cuba show, because I feel so – I was ignorant, and I had been down – this is my third trip for y'all listening, and I have a connection on the island to go down and do conservation work around the waterways around Cuba, because I'm on the board of the National Wildlife Federation, and I work with a group on the ground down there that's doing testing and with the archipelagos north and south. But also, for all of you who really know that it's an excuse for me to go fishing down there, fly fishing. It's all catch and release, but the water is just pristine. Some of the prettiest and the well-maintained water. Now, keep in mind, there's no corporate agriculture, so there's no pollution on the island. Now, that also means there's no food for people to eat, which is a bad thing down there. But the food and the estuaries are like Florida used to be 30 years ago, because there's no runoff, there's no fertilizer, there's not this corporate, the sugar farms have been gone forever. There's still a lot of sugar cane on the island, but not like it was. So, yes, I now feel like I could do an hour on Cuba and talk about their underground economy. Mike, I learned that from month to month, they'll take a U.S. dollar. They don't take a U.S. dollar sometimes. Pretty much since Biden has been in office, the U.S. dollar has been gold. When Trump was there, they wouldn't take the U.S. dollar. Just opened up my eyes for a kid who never went to college to actually learn and be on the ground. And I was like, oh, this makes sense. It even made me understand the Cuban voter more that you talk about so much, because even these folks were like, we were with the Democrats. We want to open this place up, get business going. We want money coming in. But our family that live in Hialeah, they don't want nothing to do with that. And it's like this friction within their own families. But they would openly talk about how the Republicans have it wrong on the island because they've shut down their economic engine, which is money coming in. And so I was just sitting back and listening and really learning a lot.
Let's do this. Let's make a commitment then, Chuck, to do an episode just on Cuba and the Cuban vote. I'm sure we'll probably have to do a couple of them to get the whole thing. Maybe it's a two-part series. But we do have a changing reflection of what the Cuban-American vote is with the election of some of these new members of Congress, these Gen Z folks who are redefining as Afro-Cubans, as Afro-Latinos, as progressive, as very strongly progressive Democrats, what the stereotypical narrative of Cubans are as Republicans. But for the moment, I think we've got a lot to talk about as it relates to Congress and the debacle that we saw with the election of the Speaker. I think we want to talk a little bit about that, especially with some of the changes that have come with the rules. Speaker McCarthy's tenuous hold on this majority. George Santos, of course, just news today came out that local Republicans are asking the first gay Mexican-American Republican or Brazilian.
Don't put him on the Mexican. He claims Brazilian. Don't claim him with the Mexicans.
But he's going to claim anything he wants to. So let's keep that in check. Does he resign? Doesn't he? I mean, I want to know. I've been dying to be like, what does Chuck think about this whole circus theater of the absurd that has been going on in Congress? Where are Democrats at? What are they thinking? Are there opportunities here, or is it just kind of buckling in and thinking this is what we're going to have to deal with for the next couple of years?
Well, I think it's important, and I hate to do this, but, you know, I like to give old Mike credit when he's due because he ain't right that often. But, you know, when he is, I want to give him credit. And I want all of you to remember that Mike Madrid told all of us on this podcast probably not 3 months ago, but 6 months ago. He said, Chuck, if Republicans take the House, and then he went on to say, if they just barely take the House, it would pretty much guarantee Joe Biden a reelection or give him a really good shot. And I was like, Mike, what do you mean? It's an off year. People are going to be ginned up. There's so many things. He went, look, lots of things could happen, but you should know that if there's a small majority in the House, they'll make Kevin McCarthy's life hell. Now, as I sat back during my holiday, I had internet in Cuba. And when I was with my mom and my folks down in Florida for the holidays, watching this debacle in the House, I was reflecting back that damn old Mike Madrid, as much as I don't like to give him credit, was exactly right. Because when they started having the votes, when it was more than just like the four or five lunatics who follow Gates around, but you had these folks like Chip Roy from Texas and other folks who pretty much wanted to make sure that there was enough laws put into the rules. I call them laws, the rules. To where Kevin McCarthy can't even really even have a majority. That means every time we want to have anything that's controversial come up in their eyes that's controversial, like raising the debt ceiling, cutting Social Security or Medicare, they can call, literally, boys and girls listening, for the chair. And what it means, as an old union guy who knows Robert's Rules of Order pretty damn good, if you call for the chair, you can stop everything you're doing immediately and you have another House Speaker vote with whoever's in attendance. And it's a scramble to get everybody back in that room because you got to have the vote all over again. And they will hold that over McCarthy's head. And the one thing that was interesting that what Mike is talking about is what was the Democrat reaction to this is you'll notice Democrats try to fight where they couldn't even almost not adjourn every night because the Democrats wanted this spectacle to be out there for the American public to see. Whereas if you're a Democrat, probably say, look, these guys won the majority. We give them credit, but they can't even govern their own caucus and elect them speaker amongst themselves. How are they going to lead this government? So I think that's going to be the position. If anybody knows anything about the House rules, if you're not in the majority, you really don't have any rules to do anything if you're in the minority. And I'll raise one more point. I want to kick it back to Mike because he's an expert on the Republican Party and the different factions within the party. But let me remind y'all a couple more things that we've talked about on this podcast, one of which are two states, California and New York. Both have lots of Latinos. And guess what? Both have a good percentage of Republicans that are currently in Congress that are sitting in Joe Biden plus 10 congressional seats. That means that those Republicans don't want to act like Gates or Marjorie Taylor Greene, they're going to look like they're moderates or trying to work across the aisle because they got to get reelected in a presidential year in the Central Valley of California or on Long Island in districts that were D plus 10, 12, and 15 Democrat, and they're Republicans. And I think that's where you're going to see the most interesting thing happen in the House. What do you think, Mike?
I think, Chuck, those are some really excellent observations, especially as it relates to the ability to maneuver around some of those rules that McCarthy, allowed or gave up in order to become Speaker. Let me put this into context in one really key big issue that I don't think anybody's thinking about. And by the way, you've got the right to say, Mike, I told you were right in December, and I told you were crazy in January. But here it goes. I think that if Democrats play their cards right, you could see a deal done on immigration reform. Now, I know. But let me tell you why.
Okay.
And I have been an optimist on this since 1986. There have been at least four times where I was like, oh, we can get it done this year. So this is kind of my white whale. I keep going back to this. And so I'm absolutely understand when people say, Mike, you're absolutely crazy, and they have been right four times. Let's see if I can make it five times. But here's why. You've got a more diverse House Republican conference than ever before. Now, I know that crazy black and brown people in the Republican conference, and I'm one of them. I get the thinking there, but, and bear with me, if the Democrats are willing to give the draconian border security issues that Republicans are demanding, which, by the way, a majority of Americans agree with, they're going to be able to get everything else that they want in terms of a pathway to citizenship and the DACA protections that they've been looking for and been trying to do by executive order. That's a good deal, by the way. And let me tell you why, as a practical matter. As a practical matter, there's a lot of Democrats and Democratic operatives who've been talking for 20 years about the demographic change and all of these, you know, folks coming over are going to start leading to a different and new America. I think that there's some truth to that. Okay. I think it's often used overly cynically by Republicans attacking it, saying you're trying to just bring in Democratic voters. But the truth of the matter is the demographic change has already happened. If you stopped immigration entirely, we are still going to be a non-white majority country by 2044. Latinos are still going to be the largest ethnic plurality by 2060. That's with no immigration. There's none. So it's already happened. That change has already happened, okay? And there are so many tens of thousands of people that are legitimately in line that can be processed through real immigration reform that we can still be an America that gets the immigrants that we need economically, socially, culturally, and for partisans politically, okay? That can happen. But you're going to have to give up this weird position that Democrats have been in by allowing Republicans to define them as being for open borders. I don't know anybody who supports open borders. I don't even know what that means, but it's such a powerful attack because the Democrats have never put anything on the table as it relates to border security. And here at Latin, I'll end the rant with this. You cannot get immigration reform done without increasing border security. And by the way, you should not just because most Americans agree with it, but because sovereign nations have the right to do that without being called racist. It's okay to have a strong border if, and this is the big if you have a meaningful, productive immigration process that people can rely on to become American citizens in a reliable, measurable, expedited manner. And I think that all of those elements actually are on the table to do that with Republicans with a slim majority because, and here's the beauty of it, brother, Republicans are realizing that if they do the right things with Latino voters, they'll get Latino votes. That's the great irony of this. If Democrats had stayed in the 70-30 range and we never saw this rightward Hispanic shift, I would say no way. There's no incentive for Republicans to do this. There is incentive now. There's political incentive. There's economic incentive. Corporate America wants and needs these jobs. There's absolutely every reason on earth to try to get a deal done. I think it can happen. Padilla jockeys this thing in the Senate. I think you can put together Democrats and enough Republicans to go up on an immigration reform package and get Biden to sign it. Tell me I'm crazy because I probably am.
Look, I thought you were crazy when you talked about, you know, if they have a small majority, and that came true. So I'm not going to never say never. And I've told people before in my life that when Donald Trump got elected president, something that me and Mike understand, that I'm never going to say never again. I think you're wrong, Mike, but I hope that you're right. That's what I'm going to say, is I hope that you're right. And I could see the pathway based off of something you didn't talk about, but what we talk about on this show all the time, is that the power of Latino voters and enough marginal House races to where what Mike's talking about can be plausible. I still think it's highly unlikely, but I could see the pathway as we see. I could see a win number as we see, say, in campaigns. If you look at the congressional seats that Republicans are in right now that have more than 50% Latino population, Florida 27, Texas 15, Arizona 6, California 22, California 13, and California 27. Those six seats, and then you throw in New York 2, which is 12% Latino, then there's seven seats that have Republicans in them right now that have large Latino populations, that have large immigrant populations, who would fall in line with what Mike's saying. You take those seven seats, and you look at the seven seats that Democrats control that have large Latino populations that they just barely won. We talked about Texas 34, Texas 28, New Mexico 2, Colorado 8, now Oregon 6 with Andreas Salinas. Then you've cobbled together the 15 seats that Mike Madrid's talking about, which are folks that are in the middle. Democrats in the middle, Republicans in the middle. These ain't MAGA Republicans. These ain't Bernie Sanders Democrats. These are folks who are looking for solutions, who need to go back to their districts and say that they did something. Now, they really need to say they did something on legalizing immigration. But to Mike's point, because these are middle of the road seats, they also need to go back and say, we secured the border and we did these things that a majority of people want to hear, and all the things that Mike talked about. So that's where I do think that is the most under talked about part of immigration reform, which is the new growth that we've talked about here for a year now, but people still aren't taking serious of the difference of what's happening in these elections, which are Latinos in marginal congressional seats. Boys and girls, that's never happened. And what that's going to do legislatively, to Mike's point, is give us supposedly more power, right, Mike, in the Congress?
Yeah, I think that's exact. I mean, you just articulated it far better than I could. It's these marginal seats controlled by both members that have an economic incentive and a political incentive to get something done. Let's remember, the last time that a deal got done was 1986, IRCA, the Immigration Reform and Control Act. It was led by a California president, Ronald Reagan, and Pete Wilson was the jockey in the Senate for this thing, a Californian, along with Dan Lundgren in the House, a California House member. I'm not saying that to give Republicans kudos. I'm saying that to give Californians kudos, because they're going to have to drive that vote. And to your point, if you did it with just Californians, California Republicans, most of which have large Latino populations in these marginal seats, you can get the deal done there. And there's an economic incentive to get this done. Business, corporation, Social Security needs young people paying into the tax system that aren't taking money out, right? Let alone the rest of government services. Those are immigrants, folks. That's the way that this is going to have to be done. So, again, the critical points to getting a deal done start with border security. Folks, Democrats, you may not like this, but lean into this. Take the political win. Get the bigger win here. Give up the border security piece to get the pathway to citizenship, a decent pathway, reliable, expeditious pathway to citizenship, and protect the Dreamers entirely, and lock that down. You get those three elements to a deal done, and we have done something that has not been done since 1986. I think it's possible, but I've said that again four times in the last 30 years. We'll see if I'm crazy.
So also we'll wrap up this little piece by saying that the president brought this up, but I also want to bring this up to y'all, because Mike talked about the chamber two or three different times there. Today, when I came into the studio, I showed Mike an old Union jacket that my mama had found while I was down there for Christmas. She found it in a storage unit in Texas. She drove it back to Florida. She wanted me to have it. She knew I used to wear this old Carhartt jacket. For those of you watching at home, I'll show you. It has the old Union logo on, and it's got what we call a horse blanket interior, but that it's made out of a material that even if you're welding, it won't burn through it.
That is a working man's jacket, by the way.
It's very much a working man's jacket. But the key point here is that let's talk about unions. There's very few things, and Mike Madrid knows this better than anybody, there's very few issues in the world or in America that you're going to get the United States Chamber of Commerce and the national AFL-CIO to agree on. They are enemies. They are the cat and the mouse. They're the mouse and the bird. They are, if I can't think of all the different analogies, Mike, but they don't like each other. They fight each other every day. One represents the employers and one represents the workers. There's one thing that they both agree on, to Mike Madrid's point, is comprehensive immigration reform to fix the system, because the unions need workers and the work and the corporations need immigrants to come in to work, right?
Yeah, and what really pisses me off is it's a bunch of old white Republicans that are sitting around watching Fox News, drawing the Social Security checks, barking about a changing in America. They're the biggest beneficiaries. It's retirees that are going to be the biggest beneficiaries. They need labor to come in to pay to support all the tax and government services that they're going to need in their retirement years. So, yes, the left, the labor unions on the left, the Chamber of Commerce on the right, Latino organizations, service industries, every aspect of American society, except for this older, aging white population, recognizes the need, the critical need to have not just some more immigrants, but a lot more immigrants. And until we start working through this demographic bubble, I don't know that the political will gets there. I think that it's possible. I think you could force it with just the marginal seats that you outlined in Texas, California, Arizona, maybe not Arizona. Arizona's nuts. But, you know, New Mexico, I think the votes are there to just go to the Southwest and get some of those votes, put them up. Let's get an immigration bill done. Let both sides take credit, but let's just get it done and move on. It's been 30 years, enough.
Exactly. And for those of you listening at home who, you know, think about what immigrants do the real life point while Mike was talking, I was thinking, there are three employees at my firm, at Solidarity Strategies, that were born in another country that are immigrants. Mm-hmm. Most of them came here when they were little kids. Some of them work under DACA. Some of them work under TPS. One of them is a permanent resident. I pay them every week. Guess what they pay out of every paycheck? They pay Social Security tax out of their paychecks every single week. And they can't even write a check for a donation to a politician. They can't even weigh into their government because they're not, quote unquote, a U.S. citizen. They are DACA recipients. They're TPS recipients. They're permanent residents. But guess what they do every week? They're paying Social Security that Mike's talking about that goes to old people like me and Mike. Or will eventually go to us, mainly over proportion to old white people who are taking it right now. So yeah. Mike Madrid is exactly right. Let's move on. As we talk about the changing times, we've talked about crazy Republicans in the House. There's also been some crazy things happening with Democrats, y'all. And that is, there's elections for us. Now, when it comes to the leader, one of the big things that's changed is Nancy Pelosi and Steny Hoyer and our good brother from South Carolina, the three leaders of our party forever, who are all in their 80s now, all three stepped back at the same time. They didn't resign their seat and gave way to three new leaders for the Democratic caucus and the Democratic leadership in the House. And you should know that is for the first time we have a black man, an African-American, who's leading the entire Democratic House membership, who is Akeem Jeffries from New York. We have Ms. Clark from Massachusetts, a woman from Massachusetts, and Pete Aguilar from the Inland Empire, from the great state of California. And Pete Aguilar is from Riverside, Fontana area, and he is the caucus chairman. So they're 1, 2, and 3. I think it's not lost on me that there's a black person, a white person, and a Latino. And, you know, we'll see. We'll see if, you know, as much as Mike Madrid has said he didn't and run ads against Nancy Pelosi, I've even fought with Nancy Pelosi. She was a damn good speaker and she was a damn good leader. And she kept her conference in check with the same majority that McCarthy has right now to show the power that she had. So it's really going to be seen, yet to be seen, what these new leaders are. I'm big fans of all three of them. I'm really good friends with Mr. Jeffries, super good friends with Pete. So I'm excited to have more personal contact there and I can give you more inside information on this podcast. But one of the biggest things that happened, and Mike knows that this was a personal thing for me, is that they changed the rules when they got in around the DCCC chairmanship. This is the chairmanship that controls where all the money goes for all of these House races. For those of you, again, who've been listening to this podcast, the former chairman, Sean Patrick Maloney, in New York City, or just north of New York, lost his congressional race. The chairman of the DCCC, let me say it again, lost his seat, so he can't be the chairman again, even if he chose to do it. Most of the time they don't, but there's been a few exceptions to that rule, like our good friend Ben Ray Lujan. Well, there was going to be an election between California, two Californians, Ami Berry and Tony Cardenas, and they were going to be pretty even. It was going to be a split caucus again. And Jeffries and the leadership decided, instead of running elections against each other, they passed a resolution to where the leader of the parties, Mr. Jeffries, could appoint somebody and put somebody in so there wouldn't be an election. There wouldn't be any, like, there's always hurt feelings in elections, and I just leave it at that. But he's appointed a woman from Washington State, Congresswoman Susan DelBene, and she's taken over now. They've reached out to me this week. They're starting to staff up. You know, full disclosure, you know, I love Tony Cardenas. Tony Cardenas is one of my best friends. I was supporting Tony, but, I met with Tony this week, and Ami Berry's been out there. And, you know, this is the rules. We play by the rules, and this is the game. We're going to play by the game. And I know nothing about Ms. DelBene, but I know that her chief of staff has reached out to me. They named an executive director this week who's reached out to us, who's like, Chuck, the Latino vote's important to us. We want to start on day one, figuring out what we need to do. And that's all I've ever asked of anybody. And so it's really going to be interesting, Mike, and I'll stop blabbering now, to see what happens. The DCCC is a horrible job to have, I would say, except going into a presidential year where you're only down four seats, where, Mike, and I'll leave you with this, there's 18 Republicans sitting in seats that Joe Biden won 2.5 years ago, Mike.
Yeah, and to their credit, they're making the moves that they need to make. I mean, look, I was a pretty fierce critic of the Democrats and the operation when I started to see these Latino numbers going south, both in the 2020 cycle and the 2022 midterms. They're making the adjustment. I mean, look, Steny Hoyer, by the way, was in the leadership position when I was an undergraduate at Georgetown 25 years ago.
There's your point. You know,
dude's an institution. And Nancy Pelosi, yeah, I got a lot of Republicans elected by running against Nancy Pelosi, but you know what? She held her caucus not only when she had a majority, more importantly, she had it when she lost the majority and came back and got a majority again. Like, those are not things that you see. I think that Nancy Pelosi will go down in history and be remembered as probably one of the top three, certainly the top five greatest speakers of the House in the country's history, by the way. So that's high praise coming from a Republican, again, someone who's spent a good time using her as a cudgel to get Republicans elected. Now, Pete Aguilar, right? I've known Pete since he was on the Redlands City Council.
I had forgotten all about that. That's right.
He was with League of California Cities. I knew him as a young city council member. Pete, this was actually a really interesting story. You never heard this before on the Latino Vote podcast. Pete was the only Democrat elected in a very Republican city, the city of Redlands. And I told the chairman of the Republican Party at the time, this guy, if you don't take this guy out now in a city council seat, he's going to run away from you and he's going to end up going, you know, way, way, way up that ladder. They didn't do that. They didn't pull the trigger. I'm glad, because Pete's a friend. But Pete, you know, the way this would have, the way his career could have been slowed down would be to stop him from being a city councilman in Redlands. The Republicans didn't have the foresight to do that. And now Pete, to his credit, and again, good friend, is one of the top leaders of the Democratic Conference. Tony Cardenas, of course, good friend of yours, good friend of mine. I knew him also when he was first elected to the Assembly, California State Assembly, back in the late 1990s. He also served in the League of California Cities when he served on the Los Angeles City Council after his time in the legislature. Good man, going a long way. Lots to be learned from these guys that are going to be climbing the ladder. But to the DCCC's credit, they are making this generational adjustment. Nancy Pelosi, Steny Hoyer, a lot of the leadership, been there forever. I think they did a good, if not great, job. But they also wrapped up their careers the right way by handing over the torch to a new generation. You can't say that about politicians very often. It was not just one who left. It was the entire leadership that left. Obviously, losing the House makes that a little bit more understandable. But they did it with class. They did it with grace. They did it with dignity. And I think it's going to be an exciting era for the Democratic Party to see what it's able to conjure up. I'm impressed by what I see so far. More impressed than I am with the Republicans, anyway. And I've known Kevin McCarthy for 30 years, 25 years anyway, 27. I've known Pete for a good 15, 18. Right now, I'm saying the Democrats are performing better than the Republicans are, even though they're in the slight minority.
Let's talk about that. Mike, I saw you quoted in a piece today in Politico, and I want to give you my take on it. Because Politico sure didn't call and ask me, because they were talking about these new people of color, black, brown, multicultural, who are now in the Republican House. Now, that's something that I noticed, that it didn't really dawn on me till I was riveted to the TV during this speaker vote. And then all of a sudden, there's this black man up nominating Kevin McCarthy. And then I stood back and looked, and then like on vote number 8 or 9, there was this Latina from Florida who got up to nominate Kevin McCarthy. And it seems like to me, we've all on this podcast talked about Myra Flores, who lost in Texas 34, and how Mike had talked about how they had really welcomed her in and made her a centerpiece of the party and thought she may be the new way to get to Mexican Americans to vote Republican. But there's one thing for sure, and Mike can speak on himself, but I loved his quote in the piece where he said it's a low bar. But there are more people of color getting elected in the Republican caucus. I think the key, if I was an operative over there, is how do you use them in a way to where you could, maybe do something with that. But I wanted to know what Mike thought about it, other than what I read in Politico this morning, because I did notice it when I was watching the debate.
Yeah, and I spent a lot of time with the reporter on this, and I think Politico is going to be covering this a lot more, and it's something that we are not hearing a lot about because of the media narrative of the midterms, and that is the fact that the House Republican Conference is more diverse. It's considerably more diverse than it was, but that's because the bar was so low. There's no question about that. But having said that, and one of the things that I spent a lot of time talking with the reporter about on this issue was, it's a really challenging position politically to be a minority Republican, because you are a clear ethnic or racial minority in the party, but you're also a minority because of what you believe in your own community. And the Republicans have always, for the 30 years I've been involved with Republican politics, always overplayed their hand and tried to elevate voices of women or people of color to say, see, we're not racist. See, we have got women that support us. And they do it in such an elementary fashion that it kind of looks pathetic. Now, I think that's going to change, and it's going to change because of one thing, one inviolable, undeniable thing, and that is math. The country is changing demographically, it's changing, and a lot of these candidates are simply going to be non-white European candidates, and it's going to happen on the natural. The real balancing act comes when you have these Latino, Latina, black, female candidates, whether they're going to try to be a bridge to these non-white communities or whether they're going to double down and defend whiteness and some of the barriers that non-white people have had in terms of accessing everything that this country has had to offer. That you can be both and be both successfully. Which path you take is entirely up to you. I tend to believe in the Frederick Douglass school of an expansive America and continually pushing to open the American table up to everybody as a Republican. That's why I've got a picture of Frederick Douglass right next to my Lincoln portrait here that's off camera. That is who brought me to the Republican Party. But I'm keenly aware that there are a lot of Diamond and Silk Republicans, God bless her soul, may she rest in peace, Diamond, that are simply there to be minstrels, to dance for the party and to entertain them and pretend like, what they do is they give justification and rationalization to the worst elements of white identity politics and say, it gives them permission structure to say, we are not racist because look what we've got. We've got these performance characters that are up there that are willing to be elevated for their own personal gain, their own stature, in order to not be, or in order to be considered part of the club. Now, I'm sorry to go on here very long, but this is stuff that I've been living and thinking about for 30 years. I do not believe for one moment, obviously, that that is all Republicans that in minority communities. I am a minority Republican. I know exactly what I believe. My belief system has not changed. It's why I was against Donald Trump as a conservative. I know who I am. I know where my family came from. I know my people's history. I know my community, and I love it, and I've got a passion in advocating and fighting for it. I simply have a different opinion, and that's okay. That's when we get to a healthy place, is when we can respect each other's opinions based off of what we believe, but also acknowledge that there are clearly systemic barriers to non-white people, and they have existed in this country for 250 years, and to simply deny it is just, it's a fool's errand, it's immoral, and it needs to stop. And I'm hopeful that this new class of more diverse Republicans will have the confidence and their ideas to lean into this center place where they will start trying to engage communities of color in a more meaningful way, and perhaps most importantly, decry the white nationalism that has consumed the GOP and has really forced me to be more sidelined over the past 6-8 years.
Well, I think I did enjoy the article, and I think you were the one most uniquely, and I'm glad you went on a little bit about it, because I think it's important for folks to understand the history, and I think we'll be talking about it a lot this year, because I think there will be more Black and Latino Republican candidates in these seats, especially in these seats that we keep talking about, these big 15, which have half Democrat representation, half Republican representation, that have Latino Republicans and Latino Democrats. Let's talk about and kind of start wrapping this thing up today. And next week, y'all should know that we're really going to get back into the Senate map and the governor's map and get into some of these races. We've got plenty of time. It's 2 years before the election. We kind of wanted to go through the biggest changes. And that's kind of the format, is talking about the issues of the day every 2 weeks on the podcast. And it was struck a while ago, Mike, thinking about tonight in Washington, D.C. is the Congressional Hispanic Caucus Institute, the nonprofit, the C3's, swearing in of all new Latino members of Congress. And I'm going to go, Mike. I'm going to tell everybody to listen to the Latino Vote podcast and wear my good boots and my good hat. But it also made me think about the power now of California, because the new chairwoman of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus is a Latina from the Long Beach area, which is Nanette Barragan. And she's taken the place of Democratic California Congressman Raul Ruiz. So if you think about this, you've just handed down the chairmanship from a fellow Californian male to a California female, Nanette Barragan, who is, full disclosure here, it's going to be great for the podcast. We're going to have her on. She's one of my dearest friends. We worked for her in her first election. She was a city councilwoman as well, Mike. I forgot the name of the city. You'll know it probably. But she's now been a congresswoman now for many terms and is the chairwoman of the caucus. So you have her there. Think about what we just said about McCarthy in Republicans, Californian. What did we just say about Pete Aguilar and how long Mike's known him? Another Californian. These California delegation is a super powerful delegation in the halls of Congress today on both sides of the aisle. And then you have the most marginal congressional seats in America also in the same state. And then also, and I'd love, Mike, to get your take on this, is not only do you have that, but this week you've had Katie Porter, who just announced 48 hours ago that she's going to run for the U.S. Senate in California, and the sitting California Democrat, same party as her, Senator Miss Dianne Feinstein, has not resigned or said she's not going to run. Katie Porter's more or less saying, I'm going to run whether you're in or you're out. There's already been talk this morning, Mike, just so you know before you come off of mute, that in the Black caucus, Miss Lee from Oakland, California, has already said, I'm in. I'm going to run. I'm going to be announcing soon. So you could have Katie Porter. You could have Barbara Lee. And there's rumors that Ro Khanna, Southeast Asian congressman from San Francisco. And we're going to have a lot of time to talk about this, but we might as well now talk about this California power and what you think about this Feinstein, Katie Porter, Barbara Lee stuff that's going on, Mike, and you're on mute.
Well, look, I'm going to say this. I think it's great that Katie Porter jumped in, because it's forcing a discussion that we might not otherwise have. Dianne Feinstein needs to retire. She's been a phenomenal Californian. She's been a phenomenal United States senator. She has a very storied career. Her age is an issue now, and I say that with great hesitation, reservation very methodically because I want to be respectful. But she needs to retire. She needs to stop. Okay. Katie Porter jumping in does that. I think you mentioned some great names. Barbara Lee, like you just said, just told the Black Caucus, hey, look, I'm probably going to get into this race. Barbara Lee's politics are far, far left of even California. I'm not dismissing her because of that. I'm actually saying she becomes a stronger force in the Democratic primary. She is a woman in a state where 56% of Democratic primary voters are female. She is from Northern California, one of the nine East Bay Area counties, which is where almost all of our statewide politicians come from and have for a generation. I'm talking about Barbara Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, Kamala Harris.
Mike, is that because in Northern California, that more, I don't want to call them more educated, but that demographic up there votes at a higher propensity in a primary?
Yeah, and I am going to call them more educated. The highest, those nine counties have three things in common.
What's
that? They're very white, they're very wealthy, and they're very educated. And their propensity to vote is high, it's off the charts. And so even though there are fewer voters, we should do an episode on this as the Senate race becomes more dynamic. They vote in greater numbers than even the six county area of Southern California where most of the people live. And it's why our politics are dominated not just by this Bay Area county, but really San Francisco and Marin counties. All the politicians that have dominated California politics really live in the same neighborhood. If you think about it, they're only about 20 miles away from each other. Boxer, Feinstein, Newsom, Jerry Brown, Kamala Harris, you know, all of these people, Nancy Pelosi, all of these people literally live within 20 miles of each other and yet are governing or leading the largest state, at least by population and close to landmass in the entire country. So having said that, I don't think I don't mean to upset people. I know people, especially on social media, really love Katie Porter. To me, that's just catnip for white progressives. Katie Porter is not known outside of her congressional district, okay? And Adam Schiff is going to get into this thing. If Adam Schiff gets into this race and Katie Porter is in this race, you're going to have these white progressives splitting up an already diminished base. You got to look at Ro Khanna. You got to look at Barbara Lee. You got to look to the north part of the state to find where the real anchors are going to be, the strongest voices. This is why my good friend and your good friend Alex Padilla, it was so important to get a Latino appointed by Gavin Newsom, because winning in Southern California, not only as a Democrat, but as a Latino male Democrat, is really, really hard. And the chances of Alex getting through a Democratic primary over a white progressive from the Bay Area was very, very nominal, unlikely.
Mike, let me ask you this, Mike, because you're the California expert, because you've just described two white people probably getting in, an African-American woman, historic African-American woman, a Southeast Asian, both of the last two from the Oakland, San Francisco Bay Area. What you haven't said, and this is probably why we should do a whole episode on this race as it gets hotter, is it sounds like the Latino vote could be the determining factor of who is the senator, right?
100%. And that's really where you got to look at what is going to be meaningful. How do you build a cohesive agenda? You and I have talked to a couple of people about their prospects, other Latino candidates. But look, I think this is going to be a very big field, and it should be. And look, no disrespect to anybody in the Democratic Party, but my God, if you elect another white progressive from California, shame on you, because it's one of the most diverse states. It's certainly a forward-looking progressive state. And to think that you're going to just recycle the same type of demographic over and over again, that whoever wins this seat is going to be there for 24 years. Have some vision. Think a little bit bigger. I'm not saying it has to be Latino. I'm not saying it has to be any. All I'm just saying is, can't we, if you really are the party of diversity, now's the time to demonstrate that.
Well, everybody, I want you to also know before you start bashing Mike Madrid on social media on his age bashing of old women, you should know that Barbara Boxer today is 89 years old. And so by the time she finished her next term, she would be 95 years old. So I just lay that there as facts for you to judge yourself.
Feinstein, you're talking about Dianne Feinstein.
Did I say the wrong name?
You said Boxer, but you're a little.
I mean,
yourself.
Not Boxer, myself. So
you're
bad.
Slipping.
Bad.
You're slipping too.
But yeah, Dianne Feinstein is 89 years old, and she has done a phenomenal job, like just like Nancy Pelosi and lots of these 80-year-old politicians in D.C. And I'll just leave that there to say that I do think it's time for a change. It's going to be a heated primary. Seems like the Latino vote is going to be an important part of that. I bet we have a lot of time. So far, just so y'all know, we're going to do this podcast every other week in this off year. Seems like we need to have a Cuba a special Cuba episode, a special California episode. I want to hear from y'all to hear what you want us to talk about this year. I need you to go to the Latino Vote website, where there's a lot of aggregation happening, where we're doing a lot of not just us, me and Mike being aggravated, but we're aggregating, put that together, all the Latino news in America onto one website. And so that's this year's a big listening for me and Mike, getting all this stuff from you. We want you to actually send us stuff that you want us to publish on the Latino Vote, the LatinoVote.vote website, to make sure that we're getting the stuff on there that you want to see and that we're hearing from you. You can DM us on our social media accounts, because now in the next few weeks and the months, and I'm going to flip it over to Mike to close us out, we want to hear from what you want us talking about and you helping us give us content. At the end of last year, it was all the elections. It was the numbers. It was Mike, you know, loving all the polling numbers and all the analytics. Well, now we have a time to kind of step back and look at things for a little bit and have a longer conversation around where we're at. What's this look like? Who are the candidates? What's going on in Congress? Is there immigration? So I just want to leave that with you today before I turn it over to Mike to close us out, is that's what we're really looking for as we go into 23 with the Latino Vote podcast and the adjoining website. Mike?
Guys, we've got a really ambitious agenda for the next couple of years heading into the presidential campaign. And our goal, I'm going to be very explicit, is to have the Latino Vote website and the Latino Vote podcast be a central part of the community that we're building for the presidential campaign. So, yes, we're going to be talking to the candidates that are making a difference. We're going to be talking to the journalists that are making a difference. We're going to be talking especially to academics who are doing the research that are guiding what is actually happening in the vote. We've got some really exciting plans for the website as we build out. But all of this is predicated on your involvement. So if you have ideas of who we should be talking to, if you have an idea that you want to write for us and put one of as a guest guest essay on one of our op-ed pieces that we go out to tens of thousands of opinion leaders in the Latino community, pitch us, send it to us. We're always looking for content. We're looking to build the community here. That is the goal. And like I said, you're going to see some really cool changes, some things we're really excited about. This has taken off in a much bigger way than we ever believed that was possible, but it kind of makes sense. It's kind of what Chuck and I have been talking and saying, why didn't we do this 10 years ago? But it doesn't matter. We're here now. We've got the eyeballs. We've got a lot of buy-in. We've got a lot of support. Our job is to corral this, to focus this, and to leverage it to make it as big as we possibly can. I think you're going to be really excited about what you see, but we're asking you to be as involved as you can. Share the podcast. Join the subscription list. Get your friends on it. The more that we have to offer, the better it all becomes for everybody in the community, from voices from all sides of the political spectrum, from top down. One of the main things we were trying to build here was a way to kind of elevate the voices of younger staffers, of younger journalists, of younger political consultants who didn't have, where Chuck and I didn't have, as the old guys in the room, didn't have those mentors to help lift us up. That's something that we're at the point of our careers that is really important to us, is to build out a national network, build an organization that allows for an increased attention on who we are as a community, to leverage our place back up to that American table to have a discussion. And that means we need your help and your involvement. So with that, guys, it's going to be a fantastic year. Love everything that you've been providing for us so far. Love the discussions. It's going to be exciting. It's going to be consequential. And make sure that you stay in, stay tuned, and share with us your thoughts on how we can build a better 2023 with your help, your support, and your guidance. Take care.